FT, this definition of community radio ties us together. Quote, it should be made clear that community radio is not about doing something for the community, but about the community doing something for itself. In other words, owning and controlling its own means of communication. Close quote. I love this definition from AMARC Africa. So, folks, if you care about your community, you can show it by caring for KPFT 90.1 FM. Thanks for making The Attitude with Arnie Arneson part of the KPFT Political Talk. We love sharing the heat and the light. Big and bright, yeah, yeah. Deep in the heart of Texas.
KPFT Houston 90.1 FM. My co-host is Andrew Ferguson.
Hi there, folks.
And you can visit my blog at thinkwingradio.com, where you can find the post that has all the links we're going to be talking about, and then some, in all likelihood. And you can follow me on Twitter at thinkwingradio, on Facebook at thinkwingradio. There's a theme here. So let's get to the first thing, which is make sure you're registered to vote. The next election is the general, so we don't have to talk about that much. Some of you may remember an episode at a protest in Washington, D.C., where a young man from a Catholic high school got into a confrontation with a Native American man, an elder, and there was a lot of news coverage saying, you know, his group was wearing MAGA hats and they were making fun of the guy and taunting him. And then the parents sued. So they've sued a number of media outlets, and apparently there was a confidential settlement that was recently reached with the Washington Post. The original suit was for $250 million, which apparently was the price that Jeff Bezos paid to buy the Washington Post. Just funny how those numbers coincide. So the case was settled confidentially with an NDA, a non-disclosure agreement, which kind of brings to mind how sleazy NDAs seem to be over time. It's like, shouldn't we really be thinking about what can be circumscribed against NDAs? For example, Trump actually has everyone who joins the White House sign an NDA. What he never seems to have quite grasped, or maybe he just kind of likes the litigation potential, is that it is illegal to have government employees sign NDAs, because as government employees, everything they do is supposed to be public and transparent. Which really goes back to the question of, okay, if we can have NDAs prohibited for that, maybe there should be laws that further limit the application of NDAs. For example, I mean, right in, again, in regards to Trump, where there were these two women that close to the 2016 election, there was concern that they would go public. Not that I wonder if it wouldn't have mattered, but they were going to go public with affairs they had had with Trump, and they were paid to sign NDAs. And it's like, okay, now that has already been considered a federal crime because it was like election tampering, essentially. They were essentially doing illegal campaign contributions in terms of paying these women. Different story.
Okay.
But so that was a situation where the NDA was not illegal, but the way the NDA was paid and what it was for was illegal. Mm. So now we have a situation here where essentially the Washington Post must have treated this as a nuisance suit, ultimately. It was just going to cost way more money to argue it than to settle it. So they admit no wrongdoing is the official comment, but they have an agreement, essentially a secret agreement for which they've signed an NDA. I think that there's a legitimate question here. We're not going to spend tons of time on this, but there's a legitimate question here. Andrew, what do you think of NDAs and the extent to which they should be limited and maybe how they should be limited, which is really the magic question?
I think NDAs are often thought of in the public mind as something that companies or the powerful use to kind of hide their wrongdoings.
Yeah.
How accurate that is, I don't know, but I think it's pretty accurate.
I've actually had to sign an NDA.
Hmm. And was there wrongdoing involved? I don't have to answer that.
Well, I think it's arguable. Yeah. Obviously, it was arguable because we argued it.
Well, yeah. I don't think that I don't think there's a whole lot of people who would oppose limiting NDAs, but actually, there might be. You know, I honestly don't know if the NDA, for me at least, the NDA is not the focus of this story. For me, the focus of the story is that this guy who said things that, in my opinion, my own opinion, no one else's opinion, in my opinion, are and were racist.
Well, this guy didn't, to my knowledge, say anything. He stood in the way of the Native American drummer Elder with what most people would consider a smirk. He called it a smile. Maybe his smile is naturally smirky. I don't know. But, and then his colleagues from school were the ones that were yelling remarks. But of course, they had also been provoked by these black Hebrews, apparently, who had been yelling racist stuff. So it apparently there was enough there to be debatable. And it came down to a matter of interpretation, which essentially is the lawsuit boiled down to. Mm-hmm. Media interpreted it one way. The boy said he intended it another.
Mm. Well, as far as I and only myself are concerned, you know, you wear a MAGA hat, that makes you a racist. But I should probably watch the video over again because it's a few years old. I've clearly, because I thought the guy said something, I've clearly either confused it with another incident or I just don't remember specifically what happened in the video. So I should probably watch it again before I really comment on it. But
I think you're conflating the fact that the boys or the kids he was with were yelling things.
Yeah.
I don't believe he said anything to the elder.
That's quite possible. Well, anyway, I think that criticism for political views, to be honest, criticism for political views, no matter what they are, and I mean that, is not really something that you should be able to sue people over. Like, if they criticize your political views and they keep your personal identity out of it, you know, they don't say anything that, and they don't incite violence or anything against you, I think that is just criticism.
And but those weren't the grounds of the suit. As I understand it, very lay sort of hearsay terms, essentially the grounds of the suit were slander, where they slandered the boy's character by saying, rather than merely implying, that what he did was intentionally a racist confrontation.
Hmm. Well, I should watch the video again before I comment any more on the specifics of the video, because I obviously don't remember enough of it.
Really, the SNL video of Star Trek is much, much more entertaining.
They're not going to get that.
No, they won't, but it's an SNL sketch. John Belushi, Star Trek, look it up. We did.
We talked about that before the show.
Yeah, for about an hour before we actually got down to doing the show. Because that's what we do at 5-6 in the morning. Mm. You guys really have no idea. We really need to do a pre-show show,
yeah,
which not only would be longer, but perhaps even more entertaining than the show.
Mm.
So moving on to the next topic. Andrew actually pointed me to an article from July 11 in the Washington Post entitled Racial Disparities Seen in How Doctors Treat Pain, Even Among Children. And to take some of the article excerpting, as many doctors, nurses, and other health officials or health workers have joined protests against systemic racism, research has shown that racial bias is pervasive in healthcare, perhaps most apparent in the assessment and treatment of pain. The strongest evidence of this comes from a clinical setting commonly requiring surgery, acute appendicitis. Not only are there clear racial disparities in pain relief, but they are found even for the treatment of children. A national study included almost 1 million emergency room visits. Black children in severe pain from acute appendicitis had just 1/5 the odds of receiving opioid painkillers compared with white children, even adjusting for other factors. The disparity may reflect that doctors were less likely to trust their black patients, particularly because the study also showed no difference in the prescription of non-opioid painkillers by race. This was confirmed by another study, where there are fewer objective findings such as migraine, back pain. Sort of to go to my own personal experience, what I have observed, just generally speaking, is pain from an outsider's viewpoint is really, really subjective. And typically I find you get a lot less sympathy when your illness or sickness or pain has fewer objective outward manifestations. So for example, back pain, joint pain, people can't see it unless you're arthritically deformed. And sometimes they just think you're being lazy because it's like, my back hurts, I can't walk, you know, my hands are hurting today.
Yeah.
But apparently in this article, what they're talking about is racial elements getting into this, that maybe black children are more likely to want opioids because opioids? I mean, that is kind of what the study would suggest. Now, it does go on to say that empathy might be a significant factor in this, that because the appraisal of pain remains entirely subjective, confined exclusively to the eye of the beholder, a doctor or nurse's ability to accurately assess and respond to a patient's suffering is heavily dependent on empathy, the process that allows us to understand and share another person's emotional state. Empathy is seen as an evolutionarily promoted phenomenon, that watching someone else wince in pain may help us not make the same mistake, and being sensitive to others' feelings allows us to form cohesive societies. In fact, brain imaging studies show there is considerable overlap in the brain's circuits that feel one's own pain and those that react to the pain of others. By the way, when people talk about hurting emotionally, that also involves the same circuits as actual physical pain.
Yeah. I also want to quickly go back. I'm not sure that that's the opioid study with the comparing it to you know, racial disparities in opioid prescription. I'm not sure they're saying that patients want opioids more. Black patients want opioids more.
The way I interpreted it, which I suppose was the way I excerpted it, was that medical professionals may see black children as being more inclined to just crave or want or desire opioids, as opposed to their white patients who may in fact be, you know, however you want to frame it,
emotionally
healthier, less likely to be dependent or whatever.
Right. Or it's possible that they just can't find anything wrong, and so they just give them opioids as a way to get them out the door and not have to worry about them.
Well, perhaps that too.
Okay, sure. Just wanted to quickly jump back to that.
Okay. So this is interesting that empathy can be confined to, and they're putting it here in racial terms, but also in the article they talk about groups becoming familiar with each other and becoming more inclusive as a result of that familiarity. So one of the takeaways that I had was reinforcing my belief that the value of early childhood racial integration is that you don't consider people that look different as being other. you start to become more familiar with them as individuals, and therefore they become essentially one of your group, one of your tribe.
Mm.
So I think that this is this early integration process, I think, is another argument that sort of goes back to the affirmative action argument, which is, yes, affirmative action is supposed to be making up for past discrimination, which affects the ability of non-whites to advance in various jobs, various fields. There's also, though, what I have observed over my lifetime, I didn't really understand this, as I've said before on the air, until I was in my 50s, that it also comes down to having people in hiring positions that will be able to better empathize with others of their ethnic group, their racial group, their religious group, because they feel more familiar, thereby continuing the process of making job opportunities more available to people of disparate ethnicities, racial groups, etc. So the empathy aspect and forming early empathy, I think, is really, really important. Forgive me, I'm going to take the quick ID here. You're listening to ThinkWing Radio with Mike Honig on 90.1 FM KPFT Houston with my co-host Andrew Ferguson. Okay, let's get back to the stuff here.
Mm.
Then there was another story, also in the Washington Post from June 20th, that calls for, or not calls, it's entitled Calls for Racial Justice Gained Steam with Empathy. And it raises an interesting question, which is, so many people that have been on the sidelines of racial equality have now joined in, and the legitimate question is, why now? Why now?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the essence of this story, it says, one key to this comes from research on the perverse relationship between power and empathy. We often think of empathy as a hardwired trait, but it's actually more like a skill. The right experiences, habits, and practices can increase our empathic capacity the same way we get stronger by going to the gym. Now, from my point of view, being the age I am, what I see this as is a multi-generational learning. Last week we talked about generational power changes. Mm-hmm. How 1992, the election of 92, when Clinton was elected, that was a generational change from the World War II generation to the post-war generation. And how 2020 and 2024, we're seeing this evolution now to the next generational power change, mostly in 24, but we're seeing it in Congress now with a lot of progressive young people.
Mm.
And I think that what we're seeing here is something similar, where we've had a couple of generations of teaching children more societally and more children, not all of them, obviously, about having empathy for oppression, having empathy for injustice, having empathy for other groups not like yours. And I think that what we're seeing is kind of like that generational power change. We're seeing these people suddenly becoming old enough to have impact. So I think that it's very like the power dynamic that we talked about last week. You now have people in their late teens, early 20s, early 30s that have grown up with this theory of racial and religious justice, and now they're old enough to act on it.
Hmm.
And it only took, 25 or 50 years before you had enough people of enough generations to suddenly have that tipping point, if I may use that phrase, Andrew and I have had that discussion, where now all of a sudden you have enough people in a mass that feel the same way and are willing to go out on the street and protest for it.
Hmm. It's an interesting theory. And I can see, I can see some merit in it, in that, generations do, sort of replace one another in power. But I don't know, that seems somewhat different, somewhat of a different theory to me than the one purported in the Washington Post article that we're discussing.
Well, yes, that's why I said it was my theory and not the article's theory.
Right, right.
And but how... I do think, I mean, they talk about power and privilege, and this story does depart in the sense of talking about power and privilege and how that affects the ability to empathize with others, and how having power may actually disincentivize empathizing with others, because then you can't make maximum use of your privilege, whether racial, economic, professional, or whatever.
Right. It's the idea that you don't become more conservative as you get older. You become more conservative as you get richer.
I don't even know if it's necessarily a matter of getting more conservative. And we are departing from the story now in this discussion.
Yes, yes, yes.
I think it may be a matter of becoming more defensive and self-interested, because being more progressive would actually cut into your wealth, your influence, your success. Essentially, you have to give some of it up.
Mm.
You know, when you have an imbalance of power, equality means giving up some of your power in order to equalize it.
Sure.
So I think that, yes, there are people that simply become more conservative. There have been some brain studies about how brain architecture changes with age, and fear becomes a more uppermost emotion that can impact political leanings. But there may also be more of a subconscious or even conscious inclination where perhaps the balance of judgment is made, that you can't afford essentially to be soft and empathetic because it would injure your own interests. Maybe sometimes it's not neurological, and maybe sometimes it's not self-conscious or subconscious. I don't know.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I'm more of a nurture than a nature guy, I guess. So I would probably say that I think it is mostly, if not conscious, unconscious, but it's not an ingrained instinct. So,
no, and actually the article makes that point, if we were to go back to the article, which maybe
yes.
is less fun,
yes.
that they did a study where one journalist interpreted in journalistic terms that, in a sense, power may cause brain damage. That it's not that powerful people are incapable of empathy, but like other skills, empathy takes practice, and people practice it when they are motivated to do so. Conversely, they would be disincentivized to practice it when it's to their disadvantage. Individuals who are relatively underprivileged realize they need others to succeed, or they need others for their success, in other words. Consistent with this idea, lower status individuals pay more attention to faces, people, and social cues than those with high status. In the more extreme example, think about depictions we have of the antebellum South, where you would have the House Negro. In a sense, that is the most extreme example of someone whose very existence is so dependent on this white person that they really have to be sensitive to how that person is feeling that day or even that moment. Their sensitivity to mood would be hypersensitized.
Something that I think is interesting is the way that you've read the article there. In the article, the power causes brain damage quote is sort of then immediately contradicted with this idea that empathy comes from motivation rather than being, you know, a trait of brain chemistry or something like that.
Well, I think that in both instances, and I can see your point, and it's an interesting take on it, but I think in both instances, we're talking about environment conditioning sensitivity or insensitivity, empathy or lack thereof.
In one
case, the lack of empathy is a survival trait. In the other case, empathy is a survival trait.
Yeah,
unless you feel I'm really misinterpreting what I read there. Or balance of, I mean, there's a lot to the article. It's a long
there is
article,
a lot to the article.
And I'm excerpting it even more than my excerpts.
Yeah. I don't think it's a misinterpretation. It's not exactly what the article says, but if we just said exactly what the article says, there'd be no point to think with. So.
Well, there's that. And sometimes you also get on my case later for having read way too much of my excerpts instead of excerpting my excerpts. So,
yes. So,
I can't win.
Yes.
Story of life. Story of life. Okay, the next story, and actually, this is a great time for our next station ID. You're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on KPFT 90.1 FM, KPFT Houston. My co-host is Andrew Ferguson, and you can read much more of what we discuss by going to the blog post for this show. It's always going to be at or near the top of the blog page, blog tab, at thinkwingradio.com. You can also follow me on Twitter at Thinkwing Radio, on Facebook, Thinkwing Radio. It's just all a thing. You can also follow Andrew on social media. Andrew?
Yes, you sure can. I am on Twitter at DominateEYE and on Tumblr at DominateEYE.tumblr.com.
You've gotten so much better at that.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. Also remember that since we can't take phone calls because we pre-record this stuff, this is actually Sunday the 26th at ungodly dark hour, you can either post to the show blog or you can write to me on Twitter or you can post something on my Facebook page if you have comments, suggestions, critiques. We much prefer comments and suggestions. Critiques are much more painful, but you're allowed to write them anyway. just saying. Going on to, I think, semi-related stories, there is actually an article from the Southern Poverty Law Center, because I'm very eclectic, and it's entitled Confederate Symbols Have No Place in Public Spaces. Stone Mountain is no exception. If you don't know what Stone Mountain is, the story talks about it up front. Georgia's Stone Mountain is marred by a massive carving that sanitizes the dangerous and hateful legacy of the Confederacy. Stone Mountain is the world's largest monument to white supremacy. It's the centerpiece of a state park that draws 4 million visitors a year. It's about 15 miles northeast of Atlanta, and it is a massive carving commemorating the hateful legacy of the Confederacy. It depicts Confederate leaders Jefferson Davis, Robert E. Lee, and Stonewall Jackson in a reverent light across 3 acres. The men sit on horseback, hats over their hearts, in a tableau that cannot be interpreted as anything other than a celebration of the Confederacy and the white supremacist and enslavement values for which it stood. The history of the mountain is, and I'm going to sort of abbreviate this some, it's tied to the Ku Klux Klan. In response to desegregation efforts in the 20th century, work started in 1923, about 60 years after the Civil War ended, and required 3 attempts in almost 50 years to complete. The final effort was launched in 1964 as a backlash to Brown v. Board of Education and the Civil Rights Movement. The park's official grand opening was celebrated April 14, 1865. 1965, but it was 100 years to the day of 1865 that Abraham Lincoln was shot at Ford's Theater. So, no coincidence there. Dual celebration. But the carving was not actually completed until 1972. The article goes on to say, across the country, statues and other pieces of Confederate iconography are gradually being removed from public display. Even as support for the removal of the Stone Mountain Monument grows, a large hurdle remains, aside from the large monument itself. It's currently protected by Georgia law. As part of a 2001 compromise that retired a segregation-era state flag that prominently featured the Confederate battle flag, lawmakers adopted a statute that singles out Stone Mountain for preservation. Quote, any other provision of law notwithstanding, the memorial to the heroes of the Confederate States graven upon the face of Stone Mountain shall never be altered, removed, concealed, or obscured in any fashion, and shall be preserved and protected for all time as a tribute to the bravery and heroism of the citizens of the state who suffered and died for the cause. Now, you know, at the end of the article, we're going to be talking about something that I want to call out this little bit. Shall be preserved and protected. That's going to become relevant, I think, later in our discussion. In recent years, legislation was introduced to strip Stone Mountain of its special protection, but none of those attempts have succeeded. They may yet change as public opinion continues to shift on the removal of Confederate monuments. In the meantime, creative solutions have been proposed. For example, now, I'm not sure this is correct, but it says the law does not mandate maintenance of the Stone Mountain carving. So if all cleaning work on the monument were to stop, natural vegetation would soon grow over and eventually obscure the relief. But now we get back to that other part. Shall be preserved and protected. I don't think that letting natural vegetation grow over it is an option based on that wording. Not that I'm a lawyer. But, you know, you and I had discussed this at some length prior to the show in the context of removing statues, removing monuments. I had made the analogy, however unfairly perhaps, to the Taliban blowing up the giant Buddha when they took over Afghanistan, because and ISIS wanting also to eradicate symbols of civilizations that did not agree with their interpretations of Islam. Would this be different? That was sort of the context of our conversation. You've got this giant carving. One of the three sculptures was a white supremacist, but the other two were just creating this work of art, whatever you think of it. I mean, it's not like we would blow up statues of Caligula, right? So, you know, now we get into questions of what becomes the equivalent of book burning, what becomes the equivalent of blowing up statues of Buddha, admittedly the polar opposite of the Confederacy. But, you know, you have this massive work that can't just be moved to a museum or a battlefield or a cemetery for context. It's the side of a mountain. You can cover it, you can let nature reclaim it, or you can destroy it. And this is where these things kind of start to get, I think, philosophically potentially messy. Some people might not feel that way, but I think, you know, I can see how this has a lot of different facets to it.
Well, I think I may be one of the people who don't necessarily consider it ideologically messy. I mean, you know, in terms of how it's different than the Taliban or ISIS blowing up signs of civilizations that didn't adhere to their values, is that, you know, those signs of civilizations weren't necessarily inherently hateful or about the subjugation of other people. As far as I know,
slavery was pretty common in ancient times. You can probably attach it to almost any monument, including the pyramids.
Probably, but I don't know if that...
It wasn't racially motivated, but there was slavery.
Sure, but that's the thing. It wasn't racially motivated. And while slavery in general, no matter who it's against, is bad, and which is something I really don't feel like I should have to say, but I guess I have to say it.
Contextually.
While slavery, no matter who it is of, is bad, racially motivated slavery is different from non-racially motivated slavery. And so, you know, I think from that standpoint, the content of the carving on Stone Mountain, is not, you know, in my head, there's no debate as to whether it's worth preserving on the merit of its, or demerit, as the case may be, of its content. You know, in terms of, like, you know, acknowledging wrongdoing, perhaps, you know, taking a picture of it before it gets removed or destroyed or, you know, is abandoned, and then, you know, having that in a history museum or in the history book saying this was a monument to the Confederacy, that was wrong because of slavery and white supremacy and, you know, it is never something that should be done again. It wasn't an appropriate action. I think that could take care of, you know, owning up to it, that part of it. There is, you know, a secondary discussion of what to do about it.
I just want to interrupt because I think I glossed over this in the context of what I initially read.
Okay.
This was originally private property.
Oh.
It was taken over by the state.
Okay.
So at one time it was private property, in which case people can put up pretty much whatever they want. And then it was made a state park.
Yeah.
So, maybe it should revert to private property. Maybe the state should sell it and then donate the money to equal opportunity assistance or reparations or whatever you want to call it.
If a compromise is necessary, that is a compromise for the list of compromises, sure. But, I mean, the article mentions, you know, public opinion continues to shift on the removal of Confederate monuments. So a compromise by the time that something can be done about the carving on Stone Mountain, a compromise may not be necessary. I mean, you know, to sort of go to the sort of secondary discussion of what to do about it once something has been, once it's decided that something needs to be done, what to do.
Which is the tricky part.
Which is, yeah. You know, people suggest blowing it up. People suggest, you know, covering it up. Covering it up, I mean, that could work. You know, it would be a little bit weird to have a sheet hanging over the side of a mountain.
Which then the state would have to maintain.
Which then the state would have to maintain.
Which would be ironic.
Which would be ironic. But blowing it up, I don't think is, I mean, at the very least, an ecological impact study would have to be done, because I wouldn't imagine a bunch of rock falling down the side of a mountain is going to be very good for the local ecosystem.
Let me insert something before I forget, and I apologize.
Sure.
You know, when the Aswan Dam was built in Egypt, there were a number of ancient Egyptian monuments that were going to be inundated by water. And the best known of these is probably Abu Simbel. I was going to say something else. Abu Simbel, Ramses the Great, enormous carved statues. And what they actually did was cut them apart and reassemble them out past the point of the new lake being created. The technology actually exists to cut these things away in blocks and reassemble them elsewhere, perhaps an option that we should mention.
Okay.
I mean, if they could do it with Abu Simbel, they can do it with almost anything.
Hmm. Something that's made me think of was, God, I cannot remember the name of the town now. And I have tried to do some Googling, but I don't have enough time. There is a video from the YouTuber Tom Scott that covers, it was a town, I think in the U.S.
I think it had to do with the Tennessee Valley Authority?
Maybe. What I'm thinking of was basically they wanted to expand a lake or build a dam somewhere or something. And there was a town at the bottom of a valley.
And they moved it.
I don't think they actually...
Well, I mean, there were some towns that were inundated, but there was a town that they moved.
Okay. Well, there was one town that they actually used... They moved everyone out of it, and then they used it for building materials testing or something like that, fire testing. They burned the town and basically watched the results and were like, okay, this is how certain building materials respond in a real fire situation, and then they flooded the town, the remains of the town. So, you know, if you're interested in that, Tom Scott, you know, on YouTube. I mean, yeah, again, you know, if a compromise is necessary, perhaps the mural or the carving could be, you know, removed in sections and moved somewhere else. But, I mean, to be honest, the solution that I think works best is basically just stop maintaining it and just let nature take its course.
That might require a change in law, though. When you read
it, might
part of the law.
It might.
So that's a complication.
That is. But I do think, you know, as public opinion shifts, you know, that law may become more realistic to pass.
Well, you know, in the wider context of these sorts of things, history certainly has numerous examples of revolutionary societal change that leads to the destruction of monuments that suddenly become offensive to the sensibility, whether they're statues of Stalin or Lenin or Hitler or, you know, perhaps Genghis Khan, although I don't think he was into monumental iconography. He just wanted empires. I mean, history is replete with these kinds of things. So it's not unprecedented. And it's, you know, some of us might actually feel like, for example, taking down all the Nazi iconography after the Second World War, the famous blowing up of the swastika on the Reichstag when the Soviets took it over.
Mm-hmm.
You know, most people would not disagree with that.
Mm.
And yet there are some issues that seem to be more arguable for some reason. And I think that alone is kind of interesting.
It is. It is interesting, and it would be interesting to sort of investigate why those issues are more arguable. Is it just because they're more recent in the public's mind? The events that happened are more recent, or perhaps because they're seen, they're glorified in some circles, like the Confederacy is.
Well, of course, what's interesting is that after the Confederates surrender at Appomattox Courthouse, after Lee surrendered, which ultimately led to the surrender of the Confederacy, bit by bit, Robert E. Lee was actually very much in favor of destroying flags, of destroying symbology. I mean, he was of the opinion that there should not be some kind of ongoing worship of the Confederate moment.
Hmm.
And I think that from my cursory readings, I think that that started to change as that generation began to die.
Right.
Began to have much more memorialization of the battles, the soldiers, the elders who were surviving, and of course, to some extent, a reassertion of Jim Crow.
Yes. And the existence of organizations that tried to,
To this day, there are World War II German cemeteries in France that the German government maintains unmolested. Mm. You know, it's a war cemetery, and international agreement is, hey, they were soldiers fighting for their country. You didn't agree with it, but they're war dead, and they're entitled to have their cemeteries maintained in something resembling a respectful condition.
Hmm.
Even the Nazi SS cemeteries are still maintained as war graves, as we know from Ronald Reagan having visited one.
Yes, there's a monument, I think, in Sweden to Swedish members of the SS, people who basically flew over and joined the Nazis, that was recently defaced. The authorities are investigating it as a hate crime, which is interesting.
Actually, that brings to mind when I mentioned about certain Soviet monuments in Eastern European countries. I think the monuments specifically are the war memorials to Soviet soldiers fighting the Nazis.
Oh, okay. Hmm. Okay.
But of course, what you're talking about is the reverse and something I've never heard of.
Right. Yeah. It may not be in Sweden. I may be totally geographically wrong.
Norway, maybe.
But, yeah, it's a sort of, I wonder if it's a similar sort of idea of it was a monument to soldiers of a war, and thus by international accord, the government is obligated to take care of it. In which case, I would suggest we should perhaps take another look at the international accords. But would be a process.
But, you know, now that we're making those kinds of connections, it is kind of interesting because most war monuments are built post-war.
Mm.
So that sort of leads to perhaps the thought question of how far post-war do you have to be before it isn't a post-war monument, it's just an offensive poke in the eye.
Mm. That's a good point. Is there a time? Is there a period?
And while we've accorded on my having made a good point, I just want to point out that you're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig on KPFT Houston 90.1 FM. You can help support KPFT by going to kpft.org and clicking on the donate jar. It would be nice if you picked this show, but ultimately it all goes into the same pot. Whether you make a very small donation, a medium-sized one, basically the Three Bears version of donations, you know, very small, medium, or very large, or too cold, too hot, or perfect, we would appreciate that. KPFT.org, click on donate. You can also follow whatever goings on there are for the stations. You can go to the program archive. You can podcast shows, for example, this one. And you can also text 713-526-5738, 713-526-5738. We used to use that number a lot more. And then text the word give, and then you'll go through an automated exchange about how much you want to donate, how you want to donate, perhaps to what show you want to donate to. I haven't read quotes in a long time, but this is this show, and I should have thought of it earlier because we discussed the empathy question, the empathy of pain, the empathy of one group for another, and how intimate familiarity at an early age creates that empathy. There is a quote that I once noted. It's from Captain G.M. Gilbert, the Army psychologist assigned to watching the defendants at the Nuremberg trials and interviewing them, too, as well. And the excerpt from his book is, "In my work with the defendants at the Nuremberg trials from 45 to 49, I was searching for the nature of evil, and now I think I have come close to defining it. A lack of empathy. It's the one characteristic that connects all the defendants, a genuine incapacity to feel with their fellow men. Evil," he writes, "I think, is the absence of empathy." So another perspective on the earlier discussion we were having.
Yes, and we've had our own discussion over that, and I think there's some problems with that statement,
but that's you.
That's me, you know. There are people who are...
I bet that most people will agree with me when I read that.
Well, and maybe it's not, maybe it just needs a tweaking, but there are people who just are incapable of developing empathy, but that doesn't mean that they suddenly go out and do evil things. It doesn't mean they want to do evil things.
No.
It doesn't mean they don't understand the concept of evil. So perhaps...
Well, they don't understand the concept of evil. That is the lack of empathy. But the essence of the discussion that we had about this was that sociopathy is only a thought crime until you act on it. You can be a sociopath, and if you're a very good, if that's not a contradiction, if you're a very good sociopath, you can be a sociopath your entire life, and people will never actually accuse you of having done anything wrong. You might, in fact, just be a very successful business person who has made a lot of money by metaphorically stabbing a lot of people in the back, costing a lot of people their jobs, and underpaying people for their work. Now, that could be a form of sociopathy, but it's a form that society actually rewards. Mm-hmm. So those people are not going to have any problem with the law, unless, of course, they break it. But what, you know, just being, quote, good at business is not in and of itself considered sociopathic. It's when you literally stab somebody in the back that you become a sociopath actually breaking felony laws. And that's where society would call you. I mean, I guess you're evil either way, but in one way you're considered to be breaking the concept of what makes for societal cohesion. In other words, killing people. Torturing them or whatever.
Yeah. What
I can't believe we're going for this discussion, but go ahead.
What concerns me about that line of thinking is, the people who, don't have a concept of empathy, but will never have a concept of empathy. And the people who, regardless of that, still understand that there are actions that are frowned upon by society. They understand the explanations of why they're frowned upon by society, even if they don't, live those explanations themselves, or haven't experienced them. And because they don't want other people to dislike them, because they don't want anything to happen to people that they consider important, or, for a number of other reasons, they work, within their understanding of society's laws. I don't think a lack of empathy inherently makes a person evil. I think perhaps choosing to suspend your empathy for someone does, perhaps, based on, inherent traits about them that they can't change.
10 years ago, during the BP oil spill in the Gulf, I did a piece on another station, which you can find on my website if you search BP oil spill, probably, about corporate sociopathy, which unfortunately is not a term I came up with, but I didn't know that when I came up with it. And in the course of my research, I came up with a good popular explanation for the difference. This is not a clinical definition, but in terms of trying to grasp the difference, there was the difference between what we might consider a sociopath mm-hmm. and what we might consider a psychopath. Mm-hmm. That a psychopath wants to kill you. A sociopath wouldn't mind killing you if he had to. And therein lies the essential difference, the act versus the thought.
It's a pop definition, so it's not going to be perfect, but I get the drift. I still feel obligated to point out the flaw in that psychopaths are not inherently violent, nor are sociopaths.
All right, so you're taking the pro-psychopath side, and I'm taking the anti-psychopath side. Maybe we should just
Yeah, and
only
anyone
at 5:30 or 6 in the morning could you have this discussion. Well, and actually the last time we had this discussion, it was 5:30 or 6 in the morning. So maybe that has something to do with it. I don't know.
Yeah, maybe these are not good hours for us to do
Maybe this. They're not good hours for sociopathy conversations. Okay, getting on to the next story. BBC reported on July 22nd, and you may have already heard this, that Facebook allowed Trump to post, or his campaign to post, an ad that purported to show American violence in democratically led cities that was actually a photo of the Ukraine, essentially peaceful rebellion, peaceful revolution from 2014.
Quick interjection, yeah. Yes. Capital D, democratically led cities, not small d.
Right.
Democratic.
In other words, Trump has deployed to Portland, which is a city and a state, Oregon, led by Democratic mayor, capital D Democratic governor. And Chicago is also led by Democrats, and New York City and New York State led by Democrats. And basically these are places that he has threatened to send federal troops, what I have called creeping martial law, which mm-hmm. other people are now essentially calling variations of creeping martial law. And using this photo as a misrepresentation of the kinds of alleged anarchic violence that he is alleging is occurring, which is his justification for sending in federalized, quote unquote, law enforcement. You know, this is a lie. It's a provable lie. And Facebook actually did not allow them to run that ad, which they're saying, let's see, what was the term they used?
No,
this is a campaign group, actually, of evangelicals for Trump.
Right.
Was actually the PAC that wanted to run this.
You said that Facebook took down the ad, but no, that's actually the opposite of what they've done. They haven't taken down the ad.
Ah, okay. Sorry about that. You see, that's what happens when I excerpt too heavily in my head. It says now at the end, it says Facebook has begun labeling posts on the pages of both the president, God, I hate that word for him, and Joe Biden, with links to official information. All right, let me actually go back and reference a little bit more of this. Facebook told the BBC that they won't be taking action against the post, but gave no further comment. A reverse image search showed that it was actually Ukraine in 2014. The security official pictured is in fact not a U.S. police officer, and the image is also on the Wikipedia page about the 2014 Ukrainian revolution. So, correction made. Okay. In terms of more false or fake news, from CNN Business, Sinclair, the network, says it will postpone and, quote, rework a segment featuring a conspiracy theory about Dr. Anthony Fauci. The Sinclair Broadcast Group said it will postpone and rework a segment it planned to air this weekend. This is from July 25th, so this weekend, this past one airs, that it will postpone it. The piece as composed suggests that Dr. Fauci was responsible for the creation of the coronavirus. The baseless conspiracy theory I'm reading now is set to air on stations across the country in a segment during the program America This Week, hosted by Eric Bolling. The show was posted online before the broadcast for the weekend and is distributed to Sinclair's network of local TV stations, one of the largest. I think we found the second largest in the country.
Yes.
In a memo sent to local TV stations on Saturday, Sinclair instructed news directors to avoid airing it for now. The episode in question was supposed to be this one, including the conspiracy theory. And the quote is from Sinclair's senior VP of news, Scott Livingston. After further review of this week's originally planned episode, it's clear that we need to provide additional context to the highly controversial segment regarding the COVID pandemic and Dr. Fauci. In order to meet our standard of providing an open and honest marketplace of ideas and viewpoints, even if incredibly controversial, we will need to rework the segment to ensure viewers get the best information available. Bolling had previously stood by the segment, telling CNN that he did not endorse the conspiracy theory, but was comfortable airing it because in a segment after the interview, he spoke to a doctor, Bolling did, who dismissed the idea that Fauci was responsible for the virus. So, made up history.
I think it's very interesting that this article, that the Mr. Livingston mentions the idea of the marketplace of ideas, because that's ammo for me to take a shot at that idea, but I don't know if we have the time for that.
Yeah, it's just media concentration. A story that we will not be able to get to adequately is from Al Jazeera, Saudi Arabia pushing itself into a nuclear trap, apparently looking to build a nuclear reactor, possibly pursue nuclear weapons if Iran gets them. And this is a long story that would probably have taken about 10 or 15 minutes to go over properly. But you can find it on the website. I will post the link to it as well as the excerpts that I chose.
And so, if we feel like it, we might discuss it next week, maybe.
If it's still relevant and some of these stories do still age well. So we might get to it yet. You've been listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig on KPFT Houston, 90.1 FM. My co-host and my indispensable editor is Andrew Ferguson. Thank you very much, Andrew, for your indefatigable work.
Okay.
Is that a great word?
It is. I wasn't expecting it.
That's you.
Thank you.
We will be back next week. One of these days we'll be able to take phone calls again. I'm sorry that we can't at this time, but everybody have a great week, and we'll be back next time.
See you later, folks. It's not too late, not while we're living. Let's put our hands out in time. There's got to be a morning after. We're moving closer to the shore. I know we'll be there by tomorrow.
Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, host of The Attitude, heard wicked early on KPFT 90.1 FM. I originate on a little community radio station, WNHN-FM in Concord, New Hampshire. But like our big brother, KPFT, this definition of community radio ties us together. Quote, it should be made clear that community radio is not about doing something for the community, but about the community doing something for itself. In other words, owning and controlling its own means of communication. Close quote. I love this definition from AMARC Africa. So, folks, if you care about your community, you can show it by caring for KPFT 90.1 FM. Thanks for making The Attitude with Arnie Arneson part of the KPFT political talk. We love sharing the heat and the light. Big and fry, yeah, yeah. Deep in the heart
of Texas. Get even more from your KPFT listening experience by checking out our HD2 stream. New and improved, get acquainted with our revamped weekly schedule now at kpft.org. Nationally syndicated favorites like Democracy Now!, Flashpoints, and Rising Up with Sonali remain. Our HD2 schedule now features more local shows throughout the entire day, including a